I do counter-narrative, and that has a cost. I've been around a long time. I still have my fastball, and I just have learned to pretty much ignore a lot of the critics.
Investigative journalist Seymour Hersh drops a bombshell about the Osama bin Laden raid and becomes a target himself. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Also on the show, a New York Times expose on nail salons is more than just classic muckraking. It's good marketing, too.
Somebody tweeted that every single woman I've talked to in New York City in the last 3 days has read this story. That might have been a bit hyperbolic, but it actually felt that way.
Plus, the world celebrates the end of Ebola in Liberia. But locals say the fight isn't over.
Already you can see that the complacency factor is setting in. My fear is that there may be some lapses near the border and we may have some reoccurrence. We're praying that doesn't happen.
There's more coming up. Stay with us. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. If you've read any of the thousands of journalistic accounts or only seen Zero Dark Thirty, you know how the 2011 Osama bin Laden raid came to pass. SEAL Team 6 took him out after the CIA sniffed him out.
Where was the last time you saw bin Laden, huh?
You know, when you lie to me, I hurt you.
Or maybe not. Over the weekend, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh, he of Me Lie, Abu Ghraib, and many other stunning exposés, broke another jaw-dropper. His 10,000-word piece in the London Review of Books alleged that the special forces operation that took bin Laden's life was not at all what we've been led to believe by journalists or by the U.S. government.
A small team of Americans carried out the operation with extraordinary courage and capability. No Americans were harmed. They took care to avoid civilian casualties. After a firefight, they killed Osama bin Laden and took custody of his body.
No, says Hersh, no firefight. They just shot him. Nor, he says, were bin Laden's whereabouts in an Abbottabad, Pakistan compound uncovered by a painstaking CIA stakeout of a courier. Rather, the al-Qaeda leader was ratted out by a Pakistani military intelligence officer who walked into the U.S. embassy with a tip and walked out with a multi-million-dollar reward. The informant, says Hersh, told the CIA that bin Laden had been essentially under house arrest in Abbottabad for years. And, by the way, Saudi Arabia had been footing the bill. Another lie, Hersh maintains, is the Obama administration's claim that it acted without the knowledge of the Pakistanis. In fact, he says, Navy SEAL Team 6 was escorted through the compound by a Pakistani operative. Oh, and the body supposedly buried at sea was tossed in chunks from a helicopter over the Afghan mountains. The White House thoroughly disputes Hersh's account. Hersh cites high-level sources, but apart from Pakistani General Assad Durrani, who retired from the Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate in 1992, all of those sources are anonymous, and he relies heavily on just one unnamed official. One reason the big scoop has been met with some derision from other journalists. Jack Schaefer in Politico said Hersh, quote, leads the reader into a wonderland of his own. Max Fisher, writing for Vox, said Hersh has gone off the rails, the sort of thing Hersh says he's been hearing for decades.
You whippersnappers, you should have seen what happened after I wrote at the end of 74 on the CIA domestic spying. You know, it was a great story that led to the church committee. I was just waxed, even when I did Me Lie. Oh, my God.
All right. Now, your piece is pretty thinly sourced. I mean, it's very thinly sourced.
Let me say this again. The stories I wrote about CIA domestic spying came primarily from one person. That's the way it works. This is at the New York Times. I then took that information to others and verified. Once you know something, you can get a lot of things verified. Same process. I would say this sourcing was no thinner than most of the stories I've written since 9/11 at The New Yorker and elsewhere.
What makes your narrative plausible is our understanding that what goes on between the United States and Pakistan's ISI, the security agency, is often a very shadowy double or triple game because of both conflicting and converging interests, from the Pentagon to the State Department to Pakistani political leaders facing domestic public opinion, to the Taliban, you name it. But, Sai, those conditions are exactly what made somebody suggest that you are being played like a fiddle. How do you figure out how good this anonymous information is in that environment?
Well, within days of that raid, I was hearing that there were a lot of problems from the Joint Special Operations Command point of view. I've been writing about JSOC for a long time. I know people there. I also independently got an email within 3 or 4 days from somebody I know in Pakistan, somebody I've dealt with, somebody who works at high international positions in international organizations and above reproach. I also got information that actually matched what I was hearing at the same time. That's pretty solid.
I know how hard it is to keep a secret. And the narrative that you are spinning suggests that there are hundreds of people in the administration, in the military, and the security forces of two governments who were in on the conspiracy. It just strikes me as being, on the face of it, unimaginable.
Can I ask you a question? So how many people do you think in the American government in the years 2001, 2002, 2003, leading up to the late March attack on Iraq, knew that the government was misrepresenting the intelligence of the WMD? So if 30,000 employees of the NSA and God knows how many contractors, Ed Snowden was a contractor, let's say another 20,000 contractors. So if 50,000 people in the NSA, let's say 10% of them.
Oh, no, okay, I see where you're going with this. Touche, I take your point.
One person only came out and said the Constitution is being violated. Was that a greater secret, do you think, a more important story than even the bin Laden thing, which is just an operational thing? I mean, one person only of how many? 5, 10,000? Snowden happened 2 years ago. The WMD happened 10 years ago. We've demonstrated that you can cow the bureaucracy and you can cow people to an extraordinary length in this society. Ask me a good question. Here's a question you can ask me. Do I have any evidence that anything I say is true? Evidence.
Do you have any evidence that anything you say is true?
I don't have a thing in writing that says anything. I haven't had for all my stories. It's easy when you have a document. In the story I did about Abu Ghraib, I had an internal report that was devastating. And in the Neelai story, when I was just a kid, I had seen a piece of paper I talked about that said he was accused, but I didn't have it. All those stories I was writing for The New Yorker after 9/11 were all done on exactly the same basis as this story. One main source, something you verify. The people at the London Review know who my source is. They've talked to him. I've talked to him 3 times. The basic source.
I want to ask you about Assad Durrani, the retired intelligence figure. You hang your hat very much on what he has to tell you, but Peter Bergen of CNN went back to the same guy, and he said, well, I have actually no evidence that Pakistan knew about bin Laden's whereabouts. It's not implausible, he said, but I have no evidence that we knew.
I'll send you an email that Durrani wrote Bergen with a copy to me saying, how dare you say that? You misquoted what I said. Bergen quoted him as saying he knew of no evidence. And what he said was something else. He says, I have no evidence. He doesn't have a document, but he was a 4-star general. Even though he didn't serve for years, he's still deeply involved in stuff. And he knew specifically things about the walk-in, but he has no evidence because nobody does.
Right. We're not talking about the walk-in by the military intelligence official. I thought Bergen was saying that Durrani denied having evidence of Pakistan's cooperation in the raid.
He was not a player to it. He learned afterwards. As I assure you, all of the retired 4-star guys that used to run the ISA, that was a major, major issue for them, because when Obama went public and said we did it without any help and the Pakistanis weren't involved and we fooled them. And the critical thing you must know, you must tell your audience, the whole critical crux of the story was that he was supposed to wait 7 to 10 days and then say we killed him in a raid in the Hindu Kush Mountains. We had a drone attack and we went and did the post-strike look. We saw the body of a tall guy that looked like bin Laden. We took a picture and we took his DNA, and by God, we got him. You know, at that time, we were running about 8% popularity. America was in Pakistan. Would have been all hell to pay for the army if they thought that the Pakistanis were actively involved. The fear of getting out that they killed him was just overwhelming for the Pakistanis. And Durrani knew enough about it to say categorically to me, he called it a double cross, we made it something lesser because we didn't know, we couldn't, he agreed. No language was published in this piece without everybody, every principal seeing it.
Seymour, I'm obliged to ask you one more question. This is the hardest.
I'm glad to ask. Go ahead.
At least in one of the headlines, it said that you are off the rails. And I have to tell you that a couple of your stories in the last few years that I looked at and, you know, I kind of winced concerning pending a U.S. attack on Iran, about chemical weapons in Syria, and our supposed false flag operation trying to deflect blame onto Assad when we knew that, according to your narrative, that Islamist forces were deploying these chemical weapons.
I never said that I knew who did it. I just said that the evidence we had was much weaker than they're telling us, period. I can't apologize for the way it was interpreted.
I guess what I'm saying is that the reaction to this story did not occur in a vacuum.
I don't care if you don't like my story.
I understand, but let me ask you the question. The reaction to this story did not happen in a vacuum. It happened in the context of observers seeing you on ever thinner ice, sourcing ice, and wondering whether the boy is crying wolf because there's a wolf or because the boy is just seeing wolves because that's what the boy is expected to do.
Do you want my answer to that?
I do.
Boo-hoo. Just boo-hoo. Who cares? I write my stories. I'm not doing it any different reporting that I did 20 years ago. And believe me, the criticism I had for some of those early stories, it just is acute. You're just all forgetting it. It's always the same issue. He sees things under the wall. He doesn't have good sources. And you have a press committed to your narrative. So I do counter-narrative, and that has a cost. But you know something? I've been around a long time. I still have my fastball, and I just have learned to pretty much ignore a lot of the critics. I have no idea what some of the animus is about, but most of the animus about this one is simply that everybody in America, all the press, hook, line, and sinker for the story. They took it all. And whatever questions that were raised, they shoved aside. You tell me the last time a group of SEALs flew into a strange country on a mission to hit somebody. Two choppers full of 12 guys, no air cover. Do you remember in the original plan, they were going to rappel and go down by rope into a courtyard? Are you kidding me? The electricity had been cut off for hours. The police had never showed up, and the fire department never showed up, despite the fact one of the choppers crashed right outside the compound. They had to blow it up because of the communications gear and other stuff they had in it. So you had a big fire going, you had bombs going off, and nobody's bothering you. Why Bin Laden would be living so close to a couple of Pakistan military bases with no significant backup, all those questions just disappeared. And that's lousy reporting.
Si, I want to thank you.
Okay.
Seymour Hersh's article, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden, was published in the London Review of Books. You can find a longer version of this interview at our website, onthemedia.org, or by subscribing to our podcast. Coming up, Hersh's article prompted at least one journalist to revisit some of her own niggling doubts about the Abbottabad raid. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. While others rushed to dismiss Hersh's reporting on the Bin Laden raid, Carlotta Gall of the New York Times published a piece in the Times Magazine online with the headline, "The Detail in Seymour Hersh's Bin Laden Story That Rings True." That detail concerns the walk-in military informant who Hersh says told of Bin Laden's presence in Abbottabad. Color Gall, the 12-year veteran of the Afghan War, as intrigued, if not necessarily entirely sold on Hersh's narrative.
It has some incredible claims in it, and so I think we were all pretty surprised.
When you say incredible, do you mean incredible as in remarkable or not credible?
I think a bit of both. Even I can barely believe the sort of throwing body parts out of the helicopters on the way back over the Hindu Kush. You know, this whole idea that the body was never buried at sea, and we've spent the last 4 years believing that was the case. And I think now we start to go through piece by piece what is believable and why. And so I did at least the one detail that I knew something about and I had been following and wanting to write about for some time, but waiting for that second source or a bit more corroboration.
You're speaking of the walk-in informant.
A lot of us have heard this, even from the beginning when bin Laden was first killed. There were these rumors going around that it was a brigadier in the Pakistani military or intelligence. And some people wrote about it, but nobody could really ever pin it down. After my book came out last year, I got a very strong tip from a source. And so I'd been particularly thinking and working on this. And then I saw that Hirsch had an American source. And so that's what actually made me really sit up and notice.
On the subject of details, there was one that Hirsch invokes in his piece, and that is the question of why, at the time of the raid, with explosions going on, that the locals heard all the commotion and called the cops, and the cops would have responded, except that the military told them to stand down, which does suggest that the Pakistani government knew what was afoot, and of course conflicts with everything that we have been told officially. What to make of that?
I don't know if it happened. I just have that nagging, worrying issue in my head. That's what the police told me the very next day, that the military didn't turn up. Why were they so slow? What is the answer to that? But it's not a proof of anything. All I can really say is that Cy Hirsch has suggested something, which then I start thinking over, and then I think, well, that would explain the one anomaly that I was always worrying about.
Apart from a few of the more lurid details, was there anything substantive or fundamental to Hirsch's story that you just dismissed out of hand, that made you think, as others have alleged, that he's simply off the rails?
I would never say another journalist is off the rails. But there were some things that I thought, no, that's not quite right. One is that he writes, bin Laden was a prisoner. I see him as more being under sort of protective custody. He didn't have armed guards, we know that. He was there with his sort of consent. This is another detail I disagree with Hirsch on. I understood he did leave the compound at times. He did have meetings with fellow jihadis, and I uncovered one incident in 2009 when he traveled quite far towards the Afghan border to meet with people. There were things like that that I didn't agree with. Now, the issues like the body not being buried at sea, I have no idea. You know, I don't have any eyes on that at all. I haven't talked to anyone or got close to what happened to that. So there are things I just can't judge.
If you'll forgive the impertinence, Carlotta, it sounds to me like you've buried the lead. Because if what you've just said is true, we have been systematically lied to by a lot of people. The notion that Osama bin Laden, the world's most hunted man, was hiding in plain view, probably under the protection of the Pakistani government, nominally our ally, conflicts with everything we have been told. Have we and everyone else in the world been sold a bill of goods?
To some extent, yes. I divide it into two things. There's clearly a protection of the story of the walk-in. You know, this man comes in, he's then presumably taken to the States and given witness protection, presumably under serious threat of Al-Qaeda and possibly his own government. We were told it was the hard work of CIA officers who tracked the courier and found bin Laden. That I can understand, that the government lied to us, I don't like it, but I can understand. I think you're right, though. There is a much greater and more troubling point that having found out that bin Laden was there all this time, kept under wraps by the Pakistani intelligence, what does that say about this ally? I think it's very serious to just brush that under the carpet. And that's what happened after bin Laden was killed. The administration, after leaking a few angry comments about we didn't trust Pakistan, they then brushed it under the carpet and said there's no smoking gun.
You have told me about the source that you had on the walk-in and about your reservations about aspects of the narrative as spun by the administration and by the Pakistanis, knowing that there is there. And yet, you sat on the walk-in story. Why be silent and why end the silence now?
Well, I think it was my choice. I think I never actually took it to the Times. I'm now North Africa correspondent, so I'm kind of busy in North Africa. And so when I did learn about it, my plan was to try and find another source to corroborate it, which meant waiting until I had a chance to go to Washington or to America and talk to people. It was on a back burner with me, but I didn't feel I had enough to go with it on my own. Once, of course, Seymour Hersh comes out with it and he seems to have American and Pakistani confirmation, then I could say what I also had, but I didn't feel I had enough at the time to come out with it on my own.
The back burner? 4 years is a long time.
But I only learned it from a solid source last year. So I'd been sitting on it, yes, for about a year. Perhaps my mistake. I was being cautious, I guess.
And Cy Hersh himself. To read some of the accounts of his account, you would think that he were some sort of mad hatter. And maybe some of his reporting is right and some of it is wrong. In the ecosystem of finding out what the U.S. government is up to and what the Pakistani government is up to, do we need someone like Cy in order to get the story moving? You know, it moved you off of the back burner, finally.
Right.
Is he indispensable in this process, even if he doesn't have it quite right?
I think absolutely, because the main thing that we do, journalists, is raise questions. You know, we're not policymakers. We're just sort of put up the flag, really. And we know his track record is extraordinary, even if some of it's wrong, we can at least go over it and question it all again. So I think that's the job that journalists do, and he does it par excellence.
Carlotta, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Carlotta Gall of the New York Times covered Pakistan and Afghanistan for more than 12 years, beginning in 2001. She's also author of The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. Now, a story that just caught fire.
An ugly truth in the beauty industry tonight. A New York Times expose finds the nail salon industry grossly exploits its workers.
Among the findings, the women often have to pay shop owners a fee to be hired and routinely share cramped, rundown living quarters.
New York's governor pledging to protect nail salon workers, many of whom earn low wages and are exposed to dangerous chemicals on a daily basis.
Yeah, the New York Times totally nailed it. In a span of 5 days, the Times' two-part series on outrageous labor abuses and health risks for New York City manicurists appeared online, went viral, and prompted New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to pass emergency measures. It's muckraking at its most elemental. Identify a major problem, chronicle it, and trigger policy change. Consider even the elegant simplicity of its journogenesis, which reporter Sarah Neer recounted across the media last week. Here she is on NPR's Here and Now.
I was getting a pedicure at a 24-hour salon, which is an unusual salon in Koreatown in New York City. And it was in the morning, and I said to the woman, "This is such a crazy salon, 24 hours. Who does the night shift?" And she said, "I do the night shift." And I said, "But it's day." And she said, "I work 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. I sleep in a barracks above the salon. They shake me awake for night treatments. And on the seventh day, I go home and sleep for 24 hours, and I come right back." And I thought, this woman is enslaved. And I went back to my bosses, and they said, "Why don't you see if it's a larger phenomenon?" And then I did, and it was.
The impact of this story was striking. It wasn't accidental. So we're going to look at it as a kind of case study, not only for reporting, but for marketing. Michael Luo is deputy metro editor at the New York Times, where he runs the investigations team. He says the quality of the journalism, first and foremost, prompted the story's virality, but it also reflects a new approach in the wake of the Times Innovation Report, an internal document issued a year ago which reimagined the basics of engaging readers in a digital world.
So this story ran in print on Sunday and Monday,
but we published it online on Thursday and Friday. It was a two-part series. I can't swear by it, but it may be the first time that we've run a story early that ran on the Sunday and Monday A-book, as we call it, the sort of news part of the paper. And the other thing that is completely distinctive about the Nails series was the decision to publish it in three other languages, Korean, Chinese, and Spanish. We've done some translations of stories before, but we've never undertaken anything this ambitious. 6,000 words on day one, 4,000 words on day two. We did social media posts in different languages. We took comments in different languages. And that decision was both a journalism one and an audience development one. On the journalism side, we wanted these workers to be able to read their stories in their own languages. Most of these workers didn't speak or read English. From an audience development side, we thought there was a potential for these stories to get traction overseas, particularly in Korea. And the Korean media actually really jumped on this because this is the first time we've done that.
One of the aspects of this story that intrigues me is that in some ways it is the apotheosis of the Times' new approach to delivering the news. On the other hand, it is such a throwback to the muckraking of, I don't know, Upton Sinclair and Ida Tarbell and others from more than a century ago.
Right. I mean, content in the end is king. When this project was proposed and it was Sarah's idea, the thing that struck people right away was this had the chance to resonate really, really broadly because of how manicures have become part of the grooming rituals of so many women and seen as sort of de rigueur. There was somebody who tweeted that every single woman I've talked to in New York City in the last 3 days has read this story. And that might have been a bit hyperbolic, but it actually felt that way.
Okay, Michael, stipulated, as you say, content is king, and this is an exercise in journalism, you say, more than that of marketing. That said, because of the success of the nail salon story, do you think there's going to be an explicit or just tacit checklist of characteristics that every box has to be checked for the Times to invest resources on future investigations?
I mean, when you're evaluating investigative ideas and targets, you're looking for things like real serious consequences. So as an investigative reporter, I often looked for issues where people were dying, lives were at stake. But you are also thinking about, okay, does it have a broader resonance? That obviously is not going to dictate, after all, when you think about Metro's investigative team, the story that has probably been best known in the past year is our work on brutality at Rikers Island by Mike Schwartz and Mike Weinrip. And that project, which we invested a lot of time and resources into, obviously wasn't something that was exactly a viral subject. When you conceive of a project like that, you do think about, you know, readers aren't necessarily going to relate. But obviously, we take seriously our mandate of shining the light into dark places that people aren't aware of. And in this case, it happened to be an area that appeals to a lot of people. Actually, in a couple of weeks, going to come out with another major project, and it's the exact opposite. It's not going to be a subject matter a lot of people, our readers, will relate to, but we're going to take people into that world.
So you can disabuse my fear. I don't have to worry about some sort of investigative clickbait being what rules the day.
I'm not oblivious to the potential fallout of a story that drew so much attention. And when we are sitting around talking about story targets, I could see somebody piping in and saying on some XYZ subject, could this be the next Nails? But, I mean, in the end, particularly on investigative stories, the biggest thing we're looking at is just good stories. There has never been a case where somebody proposes a subject, and if it has serious import, that, you know, we would ever say, oh, don't pursue it because, oh, it's not going to go viral. There's a deep lineage of old-fashioned investigative reporting at the leadership of the New York Times, and it would never descend to that point of judging ambition on projects based on clicks.
Michael, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Michael Luo is Deputy Metro Editor at the New York Times, where he runs the investigations team. Coming up, revisiting Liberia, where Ebola was the story of a lifetime. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. You know, when I said at the top of the show that Brooke was off this week? Well, she is, technically, but she did record and leave us this.
Last Saturday, Liberia, 42 days after the last Ebola victim was safely laid to rest, was declared Ebola-free, though its neighbors, Sierra Leone and Guinea, are not. Back in December, OTM producer Mira Sharma and I spent a week in Liberia. We visited a town that had been ravaged by Ebola. We saw how the virus had thrown all of the country's problems into stark relief, like the restrictions on free speech and endemic poverty and government corruption. We were shadowing the journalists of the Monrovia-based newspaper Front Page Africa, and our guide was its editor-in-chief, Rodney Sia. He launched the paper online while a reporter in New Jersey, but after criticism that he was too far away from home to understand its problems, he shifted his operation to Monrovia. Front Page Africa is Liberia's most widely read paper and arguably the most troublesome for the government. After Rodney was jailed for reporting one official's misappropriation of funds, thousands of readers filled the streets to block the police wagon carting him off to prison. He's a local hero. First, we'll play some clips from our hour from Liberia, and then a conversation I had with Rodney this week. So, Rodney, what are your plans for today?
Well, today's supposed to be the biggest holiday in Liberia. It's called Tubman's birthday.
William Tubman?
He died in 1971, but he ruled for 27 years, which makes him the longest-serving Liberian president. This day became the biggest holiday in Liberia.
You said it was kind of like America's 4th of July?
It's even bigger than Christmas here. People leave their houses as early as 7 o'clock in the morning. They set up tents on the beach. They have parties on the beaches. People look forward to it every year. Mm-hmm. But because of the Ebola this year, the government has said no one should go on the beaches. So me and I will go around and see if we can find some action.
Where's the Miami Beach?
Where they wrote the Miami Beach, man?
Miami Beach. The managers, the workers are desperate because the government has closed the beaches not just for the holiday, but until Ebola leaves Liberia. Fancy hotel beachfronts aren't patrolled, nor clubs, nor markets. Rodney's subtext is that these public restrictions are unevenly applied to the poor.
So welcome to Miami Beach.
What is your name again?
My name is Lafis Wembati.
What do you do here?
I have a beach business here.
And how is it affecting you?
Very horrible. We agreed to close down, but now the government is saying we should lock down for real until Ebola leaves Liberia. If you want to close down a beach, close down every activity that will cause crowd. Even a party, even a mosque, even a church,
even a wedding.
Anything you think that will cause more than 5%, it should lock it down.
Rodney's sympathy for the men who may have lost their livelihoods is paired with a countervailing concern that Liberians are growing cavalier about Ebola. Though the number of new cases has dropped to 50 a day, it's appeared in every county. Front Page Africa wrestles with that. When the 14-week state of emergency was lifted last month, Monrovia seemed to be drifting into a new normal. There's chlorinated water for hand washing in front of shops and public buildings, but people again throng the markets and ride three to a motorbike. On the day we landed, Monrovia was locked in an epic traffic jam as young people rallied in the streets for former soccer superstar, now Senate candidate, George Weah. At our Sunday breakfast, Rodney said that would be Monday's lead.
What's the headline?
Ebola, not real in politics. We've all seen how people dying from Ebola in Liberia. But you have this rally yesterday where thousands of people were in the streets celebrating. They took the shoes off, walking barefoot. They had like shirts off, holding each other, hugging, kissing in some places. Like for a day, Ebola was not real.
Front Page Africa
seems to be determined to remind people that this crisis is far from over. Why do you think people think it is?
That's how Liberians are. They're quick to forget. Everybody wants it to be over with Ebola, but Liberia cannot be officially declared Ebola free until our neighbors, Sierra Leone and Guinea, are declared free. Someone can cross over the border and come back in Liberia and infect somebody else. So that's why it's important to have this message.
It's time to protect yourself. Ebola is here. Protect your family. Ebola is here. Protect your community.
Ebola is here. Mira and I were wondering about Rodney. He was a contradiction, a young, old-time newsman, warm but solitary, open but guarded. So on the bumpy road back from an Ebola-scarred village, I probed front-page journalists May Azanga and Wadi Williams about Rodney. We find Rodney a little elusive. We can't quite figure him out.
Working with Rodney for the past 5 years, almost 5 years, I haven't been able to figure him out. I keep learning every day, you know, what actually motivates him. You see, Rodney has no wife, no kid. So his newspaper is his life. And sometimes I'm like, maybe if you had a family, you would know what it's like to wake up in the morning, you know, with kids. And you have to tend to them first before you get, you know, on the field to do your job. But Rodney will be editing your stories and call you at 12 or 1 a.m. in the morning and expects that you will be up. The other day he called me, I was about to leave, you know, it's curfew. Curfew is like 12 p.m. and I left the office around 10, and it's like an hour drive from the office to where I live, so I have to leave an hour ahead. And he calls me on the phone and said, hey, come. I go into the office and what he asks is that, why did you use this cliche in your story? I'm like, why couldn't you just say it on the phone? You had to make me come into your office. He said, don't you ever use it again. So I haven't been able to figure him out. I haven't been able.
He will blow the door. He will knock the desk. When Rodney is angry, he will slam the door.
Seriously?
Oh, then Rodney. What?
He seems so
he's a
quiet
giant.
And so restrained.
Don't push him. Hi.
You succeed. They vex. Anything you do, they vex. You working, they vex. You in school, they vex. When you buy your market, they vex. Anything you do, they vex. That's because you're looking good.
Toward the end of our stay, we had a long sit-down with Rodney about his childhood and his seeming obsession for journalism. We'll just play the part where he mentions his influences, his granduncle Albert Port, a man with a passion for exposing corruption and who didn't mind paying the price, and also another uncle, another journalist.
Besides my uncle Albert Port, my next person that I admired was my uncle Kenneth Best. In him, I saw someone who I could emulate, I could model my life after. When Samuel Doe closed down his paper, The Observer, in the 80s, I went to his house. His wife made bread to sell to help the family stay afloat, and I sold the bread when the paper was operating. After school, I took the papers in the streets, buy your Observer, buy your Observer. And I wanted to be him. He was in the States. He came to me to help him start the Observer again. So I started the online Observer. But there was a lot of stories that we ran that he didn't like. So we butt heads a lot of time. His friend, the ambassador to the U.S. at the time.
Which embassy?
The Liberian embassy in Washington. Mm. The audit report was done on the embassy funding. They funneled money through the embassy to the States. And we did a story about it, and he didn't like it. He told me to retract the story. I said, I can't do it. And that's how we fell apart. And I started Front Page Africa.
Does he talk to you anymore?
We don't speak. If I see him, I will pass. Only because I've tried speaking to him, he won't speak to me. So I stopped trying. All I ever wanted to do in life was to emulate what he was doing. And I can't, for the life of God, figure out why he hates me so much. I hope that one day, before I die or he dies, we can make peace. But I don't see it because the friction has gone beyond a point of being repaired.
Let me just stipulate, for the purposes of a hypothetical, that you're not getting along with your uncle now because you confronted him with his limitation. His friends, his alliances with President Sirleaf, these were things that he decided he didn't want to compromise with uncompromising journalism. Can you see at some point when you're older, maybe as old as your uncle is, the prospect of prison or the promise of an easier life, that you might find yourself in his position sometime?
I hope not. I won't lie to you. I can never say never. The reason I don't have too many friends here is like people who think they're my friends, they figure that because you're a friend of theirs, you have to protect them. And this country is very fragile. It's very small. Everybody knows somebody. I get calls every day from people who say, how could you do that to your friend? And what can I tell them? We're just doing the job.
Sounds lonely.
It is. It is. And I take it in stride because that's the work I chose to do. During the war, I was a refugee. My epilepsy mother was in a wheelbarrow. I took her from place to place. I've seen dead bodies floating on the rivers. I've seen my friends get shot. I came close to being killed several times during the war. You want to celebrate the fact that you came back home to help start a vibrant paper and a vibrant democracy. I don't do it because I hate the government. I'm not anti-government. I am pro-Liberia. Transparency, accountability, those are the things that the lack of them took us to years of civil war. If we don't tell the people what's happening here, they will continue doing what they're doing. It's going to be like a recurring dream we're having. They will hate you for what you write, but we need to tell these stories in a way that I think only we can.
When I called Rodney in Monrovia this week, I asked him how the news had been received that Liberia was Ebola-free.
It was a time for everyone to reflect and just be happy for once. Remember when you were here in December, there was all this talk about being Ebola-free by Christmas.
Right.
And then it went Ebola-free by New Year. Now that it finally happened, I think everyone just had a sigh of relief that it's over.
But when we were there in December and the outbreak was winding down, you said that what you most feared was complacency. You said Liberians are quick to forget.
And I'm still worried about that, Brooke, because remember when you were here, there was a lot of places where you had to wash your hands before you enter, at supermarkets and stores and restaurants. Most people are now not doing that. And prior to this Ebola crisis, there was a situation where there were not enough ambulances to transport people. Because of the international support, a lot of ambulances were donated to Liberia. Those ambulances are now being used in some places for transportation of ordinary people. So already you can see that the complacency factor is setting in. My fear is that there may be some lapses near the border and we may have some kind of reoccurrence. We're praying that doesn't happen. But with all the international support, I'm just hoping that they will invest a lot of money, a lot of time in ensuring that the borders are protected until Sierra Leone and Guinea are at least back to square zero where there's no more cases in those countries.
Now, Liberia has been declared Ebola-free because it's been 42 days since the last case. That's two 21-day incubation periods back-to-back. But now everyone understands that it can stay in semen for months and months. So, do you know for sure that there are no cases left potentially in the country?
That's a major concern for everyone. You have to stay away from sex for 3 months at least. But I would say 6 months just to be safe. There's no way of checking people to see what they're doing in their private time. I just hope that those who managed to survive the virus will be very careful and the government can put together a system where people can be monitored after this period is over, because without a celebration, anything can happen.
The new chief medical officer of Liberia, Bernice Don, co-wrote an article in the New York Times. She said that Liberia needs to be resilient after this epidemic, and she says that resilience hinges on three things: awareness, strong disease surveillance; diversity, that's the ability to address a broad range of challenges; and integration, information shared across different levels of government. Do you think Liberia has that capacity?
Well, we've just managed to get our hands on a report, a post-Ebola plan for Liberia. And they're looking at $2.8 billion from now until 2021. Most of that money has to be generated by Liberia. The thing about the government, they do a lot of good talk. But when it comes to implementation, it's a major problem. A lot of issues during Ebola was about lack of money, about lack of transparency, accountability. They have to make sure that we implement this plan to the fullest. And maybe some kind of policing system where the money that are set aside for these post-Ebola projects is somehow monitored by international folks to make sure that they go to the right places.
What's the news that's taking up front page Africa now in the wake of Ebola?
The next big thing we're working on right now is the rising epidemic of measles. A lot of kids are getting sick, and some of them are dying. And everybody pay attention to Ebola and forget about other illnesses like polio, like measles, like malaria. So we want to address those issues in the coming weeks and coming months. Mm-hmm. And we're preparing for the next presidential election, because this is Eddie Johnson Sirleaf's last term. She leaves office in 2017. So the coverage of our paper is going to be changing in the next few months to the transition period, to who's next. The economy is pretty much going back to zero. So those are issues that will have to be addressed in the presidential elections, bringing back investment in the country after Ebola. Those things are going to be very crucial to how we move forward.
I want to ask you a question. You once had a really close relationship with your uncle Kenneth Best.
Right.
Then you had a serious falling out, and I understand that you had a reconciliation?
Yeah, Brooke. Right after you left Liberia, Henry Koster, who you also interviewed when you're in town, he had my uncle Kenneth Best on his morning radio show, and Mr. Best had some good things to say about me. I think he had heard on the media program also about what I said about him. So Henry Koster actually ambushed me. He called me in to say that we're going to discuss something else about politics. And I'm talking, and Henry Koster leaves the studio and goes outside for a minute. And then my uncle walks in, and we broke down and started crying. He told us stories about how we worked together back in the day, and I told some stories, and we just reconciled. And after that show, we had at least five or six meetings. He made me what I am today. I think he realizes now that sometimes the student learns too much from the master and tries to do too much than what the master knew. So, but I'm glad it happened, because life is too short for people to have old grudges, and I'm glad that we're able to put things behind us.
Me too. Rodney, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brooks. I miss you guys. I hope you guys come back soon.
We really miss you too.
Without Ebola.
Without Ebola. Rodney Sia is the founder and editor of Front Page Africa.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Kasia Mihailovich, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Jenna Cagle. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon. Kathy Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be completely back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
So did you know we made a House of Cards podcast called On House of Cards? We've just finished the last one with show creator Bo Willimon. Other guests included Cokie Roberts and Linda Wertheimer, Dan Savage, and Nixon White House counsel John Dean. Also the man who plays Doug Stamper, who's really quite an actor.
In the window, I was just like, oh my God. I just freaked out. Yeah, so...
You're such a mushy person, Michael Kelly.
Yes, I am, actually. In real life, I'm nothing like him.
Some say the podcast is even better than the show. You can find it on our website at onthemedia.org.